Amazon 5-Star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by Eva Longoria. Tonight's review, Sports Briefs.
Oh, boy.
Where do I even start with these performance mesh boxer briefs? These boxer briefs are like a magician's trick. You know the one where you go, where did that rabbit come from? So if you're looking for underwear that not only performs well, but also gives your package the attention it deserves, then look no further. 5 stars, Nicolicious. Shop the perfect gift this holiday season on Amazon.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor speaking to Professor Nick Lloyd, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College London. His new book is The Western Front, The History of the Great War, Volume 1. We attend immediately to the larger than legend personalities of the four powers, Germany, France, Britain, and America as the final power. We begin with Germany because a man named Moltke, a man who is the relative of an earlier commander of German forces, is in charge of the Schlieffen Plan in August of 1914 in conversation with the Kaiser. And I learned from you, Nick, that the Kaiser favored Moltke, but Moltke was a man who was dealing with the ghosts of his ancestor and also of Schlieffen. What do we need to know about Moltke that he took it upon himself to alter the Schlieffen Plan in the attack on Paris?
Yes, you've got the pressure on someone like Helmut von Moltke the Younger. That's his title, his full name. Is enormous in 1914, and he's not up for it. He's a man that is, as you say, bowed down by the weight of victory that his uncle achieved in 1870 and 71 in the Franco-Prussian War. And he is, you know, he's concerned about the plan, the Schlieffen Plan, envisages a massive attack through Belgium and the Low Countries that will essentially outflank the French frontier fortresses the French have built, get the French army into the open and destroy it in a grand battle of envelopment. It's one of the most ambitious military plans you'll ever likely to see. But Moltke, you know, he feels very vulnerable and he feels quite insecure about having to do it, and ultimately doesn't have the nerve to actually put it into play in the way that Schlieffen envisaged, with that right wing, that sort of swinging door would be as strong as possible. So Moltke begins to alter the balance of forces. So he puts a little bit more force in the south on his left so that it's not going to be as powerful. And ultimately, he is already having doubts about whether this can be done, whether he can do it, what this is going to envisage. And so, you know, by mid-September, he's essentially been pushed aside because he's had a nervous breakdown. But I think early on in the book, you see the enormous pressures these people are under and the kind of steel and the kind of nerve you would need to perform well on something like the Western Front.
The Kaiser himself, Wilhelm, at various times he seems withdrawn or he's not ready for news. Other times he doesn't make decisions sharp enough, or he doesn't trust his generals. Did he change through the war, Nick?
I don't think he changes. I think his character, as you know, many historians have pointed out, he's like a weather vane. He moves. You know, he can be very committed to one thing one minute, and then the next minute he'll lose interest or he'll switch to a different position. So for those people around him, they'd never really know where he is and what he's thinking. And ultimately, although he's a sort of commander-in-chief in name, he's not really involved in the day-to-day war. He can make important interventions at times. He can sack generals. He can promote people. He can have the say on grand, you know, something like submarine warfare. But he's not in a day-to-day commanding role. But of course, as the war goes on and you get a number of people involved that become very, very well-known, particularly Hindenburg and Ludendorff from 1916, the Kaiser kind of shrinks. He becomes less, not less important, but as a figure, he becomes less of a figurehead and he becomes sort of, in the shadows. And of course, he's quite insecure about all of this. And so he finds the whole war quite frustrating. And I think one of his early diary entries, he says to a friend, he says, well, you know, people think I command, but I don't. I just sort of, I go for walks and I chop wood.
Falkenhayn replaces Moltke in 1914, a man whom you identify as young for his post when he's raised up. He has steel. That's the only metaphor that I can think of in his backbone. What do we need to know about his vision of the battlefield?
Well, of course, you know, you've got this general sort of merry-go-round, and you see this through the book where certain generals become hired, fired, some generals will do well, and they'll go, they get promoted, and then they'll fail, and they'll go back, and some even recover. Falkenhayn is a Prussian minister of war, so he's in an important position, and then he takes over from Moltke. And I think Falkenhayn is interesting for a number of reasons, but of course he's the architect of the Verdun Offensive, which is a battle which, in some ways, it sort of defines the Western Front, the battle that was fought predominantly to kill Frenchmen. There were no real territorial objectives. It was designed to kill the enemy in an attritional sense. So in some ways, Falkenhayn is quite a unique figure because most of the German generals, including von Moltke and including his successors, want to achieve a decisive battle based on maneuver. Falkenhayn doesn't really want to do that. And that's why I think Falkenhayn's an interesting character. And it also points to, I think, one of the great themes of the book, which is these different ideas about how you fight warfare that we get through different generals. Certain generals want to be more attritional. Certain generals want to be more maneuverist, want to be more based on mobility. And ultimately, nobody really knows what is going to be doable, if I can use that word, or what you can actually achieve on the Western Front, because it's such a, I call it a cauldron of war. It's such an intense exercise in violence that all these commanders are rapidly trying to work out what you can actually do in this new environment.
Bethmann Hollweg, the prime minister. I mention him because he is a man who's devoted to refusing Falkenhayn's wishes for unrestricted submarine warfare. Why did Bethmann Hollweg hold back, and how did he contribute to the troubles on the battlefront?
I think in Germany, you have quite a, the role of the politicians is, I think, quite significantly reduced or sort of lowered compared to the politicians in the West, in France and Britain. And those politicians, David Lloyd George, Clemenceau, they become more important as the war goes on. And they claw back some of the power that had been ceded to the generals in the early part of the war. I think with Germany, it's quite different. I think German politicians are in a weaker position, and the military hierarchy, the supreme command, have much more power, and they run the war. But of course, in terms of foreign policy, submarine warfare strikes at that quite deeply. So Bethmann Hollweg, I think, is in some ways, he shares a lot of the maximalist ideas about, you know, Germany's role in Europe and what Germany can expect if she wins. But he's worried about a number of different things. They're worried about the Americans. They're worried about whether they can actually achieve submarine warfare. They're worried about the damage this will do diplomatically to the, you know, Germany's reputation. So in some ways, it's a difference over tactics. Falkenhayn and others want to use every weapon at their disposal, whatever it might be, to the maximum that they can. And I think that's a great failing of the German military, we see both in the First and in the Second World Wars, is tactical and operational effectiveness is elevated far higher than it should be. Political, diplomatic, strategic issues are kind of relegated to a secondary position. And that ultimately is fatal to the German ability to translate battlefield success into strategic victory.
The book is The Western Front, History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, Nick Lloyd. We've mentioned the German authorities, the people who will make decisions early in the war, and Nick mentioned Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who will enter in 1916 and will address those after the catastrophe of Verdun and Somme. However, we're going to turn to the French now, because as Nick's work explicates, the French participation in the war was outsized. The sacrifice was outsized. It was largely fought in France and Belgium, entirely here. All the suffering was in France. And the Versailles Treaty that ended the war is explained often as French revenge. You can see the basis of it as we watch the French fight the war against Germany that invaded France. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.